Rocket engines ignited, and Dan felt as if he were being fired out of a cannon. A 40-ton anvil slammed into his chest. His eyeballs started sinking into his head. There were no windows along the cabin to look out of, and he couldn't have turned his head anyway. He just sank into the cushioned acceleration couch and tried to breathe. He couldn't lift his arms off the seat rests, couldn't even wiggle his toes inside the heavy boots. His vision blurred, and everything turned a lurid reddish tint, like being in a photo lab with the safety lights on. "I'm too old for this sort of thing," Dan told himself. "What in the seven cities of Cibola made me think I should take this double-damned roller coaster?" After several lifetimes, the pressure eased somewhat. Dan heard a bang and felt the cabin shudder. Booster separation, his mind told him. The boosters dropped away and were riding on the space plane's engines now. And then it all went away. The pressure vanished. Dan's arms floated off the armrests. His stomach gurgled, but he remembered to refrain from making sudden head movements.
"Woo-wee!"
one of the women whooped.
"That was a ride!"
"Let's do it again, Daddy!"
Dan grinned weakly and concentrated on not throwing up. There was plenty of handshaking to do at Arlington National Cemetery. While the honor guard of soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines got out of their trucks and began to arrange their ranks and flags, Senator Thornton worked her way through the VIP stand, saying hello and exchanging greetings with politicians and bureaucrats. She noticed that Secret Service bodyguards were arriving now, trying to look unobtrusive as they scoped out the crowd with special electro-optical scanners disguised to look like fashionable sunglasses. The president would be arriving soon, Jane knew. His motorcade of limousines and motorcycles has probably already left the White House and is making its way around the Lincoln Memorial. It was somewhat ironic that the nerve center for the nation's elaborate network of spy satellites was buried deep underground. Beneath enough reinforced concrete to survive even a nuclear strike, dozens of technicians monitored screens that showed virtually every square inch of the Earth's surface, land and sea. Ships were being tracked, even submerged submarines. Not a truck or a train moved without some satellite high up in orbit watching it. The room hummed with electrical power. It was large and generously air-conditioned, yet it still felt sweaty, hot, and crowded, with all the technicians seated at row after row of consoles. Even on this holiday afternoon, there was an intent man or woman hunched over each console, monitoring each screen. The strip lamps along the ceiling were dim. Most of the light came from the display screens, flickering eerily against the concrete walls. Nothing much out of the ordinary was happening, though, so the duty officer should have been relaxed. She was not. A Navy lieutenant commander, she was a woman who ached for command of a capital ship at sea, but instead was stuck with babysitting a bunch of spy eyes in the sky. She had been surprised when the Deputy Director of Homeland Security entered the monitoring center escorted by a pair of Marines. In quick order, her surprise gave way to interest, and then to irritation. "Track an electronic beacon?" she asked the Deputy Director for the third time. She looked again at the flimsy sheet of specifications he had handed her. "With this low a signal?" She shook her head. The deputy director was in his mid-50s, a lifelong bureaucrat who had been in the Treasury Department before Homeland Security had opened new paths for career advancement. He was good-looking in a chisel-featured cosmetic surgery way. He was accustomed to persuading people who were reluctant to comply with his wishes. He was not accustomed to being rebuffed, especially by a woman in uniform. "Commander," he said softly over the muted hum of the consoles, "this request comes from the very highest level of the Homeland Security Department. The request originated with the FBI. It also has the CIA's approval, I might add."
"I don't care if it comes from the Oval Office," the lieutenant commander said. "That signal is just too weak for our birds to pick up. What kind of a freaking dumb John set up this pitiful little squeaker?"
"Ferret satellites have picked up signals a lot weaker than this one." Waving the spec sheet in his face, the captain said,
"Yeah, but it's not just the power of the signal all by itself. It's the signal-to-noise ratio. Your beacon's too goddamn close to the port of Marseille. There's all kinds of chatter coming out of the city on every frequency you can imagine. It'd be like trying to listen to a mouse fart in the middle of some Italian opera.
The deputy director performed a dramatic sigh.
So, am I supposed to go back to the director of Homeland Security and tell him that you won't even try to track their beacon?
The lieutenant commander heard his unspoken words. That would not be a positive career move for you. She also realized that this must be just as important as he claimed to get a deputy director down here on a holiday afternoon. She stared at the spec sheet again, grumbled something too low for the deputy director to make out, and walked off to one of the monitoring consoles. Washington, D.C. From the giant structure of the power satellite, 22,300 miles above the equator, an invisible sword of energy lanced down toward Washington, D.C., powerful enough to kill anything in its path. It touched the ground in Bethesda and marched south-southeast, piercing the fat little clumps of cumulus cloud that floated across the land as it swept inexorably toward its target, Arlington National Cemetery. Birds fell out of the sky, their feathers scorched, their innards exploded by the sudden blast of heat. Grass curled and browned as the beam swept by. Newly leafed trees puffed tendrils of smoke. Like a finger of death, the energy beam swept slowly across the District of Columbia. The water of the Potomac sizzled briefly as 10,000 million watts of energy crossed the river and reached Arlington. Automobile ignition systems conked out. Cars on the Key Bridge suddenly lost power and banged into a snarl of dented fenders and crumpled trunks. People inside the cars fainted from sudden heat shock. Several died, slumped over their steering wheels. Electronics systems shut down in home after home. Children wailed that their computer games had crashed while their parents clicked fruitlessly at the remote controls of their suddenly blank TV sets. A power transformer on a telephone pole just outside Meriden Hill Park blew out in a spectacular shower of sparks and smoke. The children playing on the grass were startled. Mrs. Rhonda Bernstein, minding her grandchildren at the park while her daughter and her fumble-fingered son-in-law prepared their backyard picnic dinner, was alarmed enough by the transformer's blowout to fish out her cell phone and call 911. The phone didn't work. Frowning, she shook it and pecked at the minuscule keyboard again. Not a peep. These damn cheap things never work when you need them, she thought angrily. Some bargain. She was perspiring, she realized. I haven't had a hot flash in 5 years, she thought. But this was worse. She couldn't catch her breath. The blood was thundering in her ears, and the children had stopped playing. None of them was running around anymore. Two of them had fallen to the ground. The others just stood there looking scared. Then she saw that the grass was turning brown. Before her eyes it was curling up and browning, just as if somebody had thrown it into an oven. She had strength enough to get to her feet before she collapsed to the ground with a fatal heart attack.
"Hey, the magnetrons have come back up," called one of the technicians at the control center in Matagorda.
Lynn Van Buren hurried over to the woman's console and saw that indeed the satellite's magnetrons were up to full power again. It can't be Dan and the crew. They're not even halfway there yet. She had to stand on tiptoes to see over the console and yell to the guy two rows away,
"What are you getting from White Sands?"
"Nothing," he answered. "Not a milliwatt." Van Buren frowned, thinking, "The power sat's beaming power again, but the rectennas aren't receiving a thing." Her pulse began to race. She could feel her heart thumping beneath her ribs. This could be bad, really bad.
"Something screwy here," called one of the other technicians.
Van Buren hurried over to his console.
"Look at the accelerometer record," he said,
tracing a finger along a curve that glowed red on his screen against a rapidly changing set of alphanumerics.
"The bird's moving." "It can't be. Look at the friggin' numbers."
Van Buren stared.
"It's being maneuvered," she blurted. "Not by us," said the technician. "We haven't budged her since we settled her in that geosync slot months ago."
Van Buren raced to the communications console,